What's up, everybody? Thanks for listening to the Fathom and Friends podcast. I'm your host, Adam Tiller. I want to say thanks to everyone listening. As a reminder, please follow us on Instagram at FNFPod. Also follow our cartoon on Instagram at Beefcake and Butterball. Please share this podcast with a friend to help us reach new listeners. For all the content, go to AdamTillerComedy.com.
It's been a short ride, but man, it's been a crazy one. The shit we seen and overcame and all of it has made us some hell of a bunch of kids. Of stories for the ages of how the hell we got here. You can read it in the pages of receipts and tweets and poems that we left along the way. Every day is something new. I see the look on mama's face. I know this world is sick and it's twisted. The kids never listen. My prince in the system invents on a pistol. I never seen him use it, but he pulled it out a couple times.
And that was Travis Thompson with the intro music. My guest today was the driver of the 77 stock car at Catamount and Thunder Road race car tracks in Vermont. He's also my grandfather, well known in these regions as the Kentucky Colonel. Excited to welcome Tom Tiller Sr. Thanks for coming on.
Well, thanks for asking me.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it. I really do.
Yeah, we got a lot of fun stuff to talk about. Let me make sure. I'm in frame. We both look good. You look into the camera for me for a second.
Yeah.
People get a good look.
How do you like that? Do I look okay?
Yeah, I think you look good.
Okay.
It's generations of Tiller.
I look better when I was about 20.
I was looking at pictures of you from earlier today.
Yeah, I heard you and your dad was going through some pictures.
Yeah, the wedding pictures.
When was that? That was back. Yeah, that's before I started racing.
Yeah. Get that zoomed in a little bit. But looked pretty decent. That was when you moved right up from Kentucky?
No, that's when I was in service. I was in the Air Force, and that was taken when I was in service.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was in the Air Force for 4 years before I ever got into racing.
Yeah. And that was, but you didn't start service in Kentucky. It was up here.
I joined the service in Kentucky and went to Texas and then transferred up to Vermont and spent the rest of my 4 years here.
Gotcha. But where, yeah. You were originally born in Rush. Some of this, like we've talked about, but
I was originally born in Rush, Kentucky.
Yeah.
And that's in the tri-state area. Near Ohio and West Virginia.
Right on the border.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And lived there until I was, able to go in service. And I went in I enjoyed it. And I didn't transfer around too much. And I was certainly never in any conflict or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It was all peacetime when I was in.
But what was Rush like? Like, you didn't...
Well... There was probably a dozen houses in Rush spread out. It was a rural. When I first was born, I can remember, we didn't have electricity. We didn't have we didn't have indoor plumbing. We had an outhouse, and my grandmother raised me and grandfather. My grandfather passed away when I was very young. And so I lived with my grandmother until I was able to go in service. And
What about your mom, though? Was she there, too?
No, I never lived with my mother. No.
Or you didn't even know your dad, right?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
But Tiller's her last name, right?
Tiller was, I took my mother's last name because of my grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
He was... the best person in my whole life, my grandfather. He was such a wonderful person. And he passed away when he was like 48, 49 years old. He was very young from a heart attack. And I think that's why. Back then, they didn't really have the, ability to know what was wrong with everyone. And
yeah, what was it even like where you were growing up? I mean, it's so different from what today is.
God, Adam, it was completely different.
Yeah,
it was all rural. I mean, I lived out in the country, and we had a church, a Baptist church that we went to regular. My grandmother took me to church,
mm-hmm.
and And we had probably, at a meeting, maybe 20 people. And I had to go to Sunday school every Sunday morning. It was interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting. And when I came to Vermont, I really thought I was going off the end of the earth. I rode a train up here from Texas. It just kept going and going, and we stopped and picked up milk. And that was in 1956 when I came up here.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a lot different than it is today in Vermont.
Why'd you enlist in the service, though?
On a dare? We were playing pool at a local pool place in Ashland, Kentucky, which is very close to Rush. That was a big city, Ashland. And there was a friend of mine named Bobby Jack Burton. Bobby Jack was his name. We walked by the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines recruiting. And he said, let's join the Air Force. And I said, I don't think so. He said, you're chicken. I said, don't call me chicken. So we went in, talked to the recruiter, signed up. He failed and I passed. So that was how
did
I
did you ever see him again?
Oh, yeah. He turned out to be, he's passed away now, but he turned out to join the Army, served a tour in the Army. I'm not sure how long he was in. And he became a minister somewhere down south, but I'm not sure where. And I saw him maybe 15 years ago, and that's the last time I ever heard of him.
Was that just weird as hell to see him after that much time?
Not really. It was good to see him. His sister married my half-brother.
Okay.
So I kind of kept up with her through her. About him, but I only saw him that one time after we separated our military career.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Before we keep going, I just want to say, if you are watching us on YouTube, hit that like button, subscribe, hit the notifications bell so you don't miss our upcoming content. And then we are on Patreon, patreon.com/FNFpod. So you, like, when you were in Rush, you had mentioned this to me before, and I want to get to Vermont, but, like, growing up, like, didn't you say just you could drink as soon as you put money on the counter?
Well, the best I can remember, if you were old enough to lay money on the counter, you'd get a beer.
Yeah. So and how old were you when you were started drinking?
I remember when I got my cat pistols for Christmas, being under the influence a little bit.
What are cat pistols?
They were toy guns.
Oh, gotcha.
You shot caps in.
Cap pistols, gotcha. Cap I thought pistols. You said cat. I was like,
no, not
like,
cat. Cap pistols. And my grandmother that raised me was, after my grandfather passed away, we didn't have a lot of money. We lived out and to heat. I dug coal. We burned coal in a wood, like a wood stove or a coal stove.
Yeah.
And that's how we heated our place. And we cooked on a wood or a coal stove, or she did. And there was, I can remember one thing that still sticks in my mind was my aunt. Actually, it was two of my aunts, but they were like my sisters, you know. Four of us lived on $45 a month.
Damn.
She got a Social Security check, and we went to school. Teresa and I went to school, and that's what she had to live on. And she done housework for extra money, my grandmother did. And that's another reason I kind of left there, because I couldn't see too much of a future for myself staying there.
Yeah.
And so
you would just put a lump of coal?
No, coal is, it burns, coal is mined down there. It was very common, big time. I mean, common is, they had three or four different grades of coal. Mm-hmm. They had, the lower the number, the lower the grade of coal, at altitudes, or, you know, low in the ground was number six, a little higher up was number seven, mm-hmm. then number eight, and I'm not sure about number nine. I think they had a number nine coal. And coal is in veins in the ground, and you make a mine, and number seven coal was the most popular. And that ran in veins about, I'd say, average 3 feet. Mm-hmm. So the way my grandfather used to dig coal, and he sold it, and I think he got a quarter ton for it or something like that, mm-hmm. work all day for a dollar or $2, and you'd dig into the mountain or the hill, we call it a hill, and you'd find a vein of coal, and you put a straight mine, a shaft, they called them, back into the hill, and then you put rooms off of that. Mm-hmm. But you always had to leave coal as a support to hold the earth. And above the vein of coal, you had slate. It acted as a ceiling. And under that slate, I didn't know too much about it. I was too young. But I remember my grandfather taking a pick that he dug with and hitting the slate to tell where it was loose or should come down.
Yeah.
And it was in layers. And then they used to put, they would cut like 8x8s, the best I can remember, and put underneath that to support it. And once in a while, they'd have, you know, the mines would fall and people would get killed.
Yeah.
And that happened pretty frequent.
God damn. But you were burning it in your house?
Well, you brought it out in buckets, mm-hmm. and of course it was manageable. You know, it was something like gravel, or mm-hmm. you could burn it as slack, what they call slack. That would be something that would come off of the coal when you dug it, little pieces.
Yeah.
You could burn that. And then they had the big commercial strip mining with machines, you know, that they done. I think now they have stopped that.
It had to have been so bad to breathe that in at night.
Well, you
right?
had a chimney that went up, much yeah. like a chimney you have on a wood stove.
But even like with that, like, because weren't you like drying tobacco and you were like drinking and like that? It just had to have been kind of a aggressive environment to be in.
No,
it wasn't.
No. Hell, they still burn coal today for all these power plants.
That's true.
You know, and it there wasn't that much of it, you know, where I was at.
Yeah, but wasn't it one? Weren't you guys all in one room at the house you were in?
Well, we had a 4-room log house.
Okay.
And the stove was in the living room part of the house. It was mm-hmm. kind of in the center.
I thought it was one open space for everything like that.
No.
So you had different
sections.
We had
rooms.
That's good.
We had a house. It wasn't, we weren't homeless.
Yeah. Yeah. But you went back there not too long ago, right?
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah. I've been back several times, and I don't know today when you were looking through photographs, did you find any pictures of that house?
I didn't see it today. I've seen them before though.
I have some, yeah. I have pictures of it.
Yeah.
And I have one on my wall actually.
Do you ever wish you would have stayed?
Not really.
I
think if I'd have stayed in Kentucky, I'd have probably married,
a cousin or something.
A girl from there that I knew quite well. Yeah. And we would have had probably a bunch of kids. And I just lived my life digging coal.
Yeah, till you were 48.
But the Air Force gave me discipline. It made me my life, really.
Yeah.
It did.
Well, so you ended up in Vermont for that. What were you doing?
In Vermont, I was stationed at Fort Ethan Allen, when the Air Force was here. That's over in Colchester.
Yeah, I've been by there.
And it was an active Air Force base. We had fighter jets, and they were a support group for the bombers out of Plattsburgh. And I believe it was Plattsburgh. They were support squadron, fighter squadron. And I worked in as a welder and in the maintenance shop in the main base. And I also had a tire shop, and I had a battery shop. So I had three or four different shops that I was in charge of, you know.
How did you learn all that stuff?
Mostly from young age. My uncle in Kentucky had a garage. Mm-hmm. And when I was very young, I started going there when I was like, I was kind of on my own from the time I was about 9 or 10 years old. My grandmother I lived with, but I pretty much was on my own.
Yeah.
And I just, I guess, lucky. And I had people that loved me and took care of me. I really did.
What was he working on?
Well, he'd work on cars. He was a mechanic, and he also worked in a place where they rebuilt engines. Very mechanically inclined, and he taught me a lot of things. So when I went in the Air Force, I took an aptitude test to see what field I would be in, mm-hmm. because you just joined and you take a test and whatever
they direct you.
The score. I think there was five different things you could do, and with the mechanical part of it, I've done fine. I didn't even go to tech school. I bypassed tech school, and they sent me to Ethan Allen to be a mechanic.
Were you good once you got there? Was there a learning curve?
Not discipline was a learning curve, I guess. that was a hard learning curve.
Yeah.
But mostly I got that from basic training. 3 months basic training, really, you're either going to make it or you're not. Mm-hmm. And if you don't make it, you're out, and goodbye, Charlie. I mean, they don't.
What did they have you doing?
What, in basic?
Yeah.
Actually, physical training, marching. We had to go out and shoot guns and, you know, pass that and take a gun apart and put it back together and stuff like that. Just, I think the Army still does it every day.
For sure.
And it's mostly just to teach you discipline. And it's the best thing in the world.
Yeah.
I think that every person in school that goes to school should have a month or two or even 3 months of basic training like the service has.
Yeah.
Not everyone agrees with me, but I feel that way.
Why was it so important for you?
Because it just taught me right from wrong. I mean, it just, and it helped me through my whole life. If you plan something, try to do it right.
Yeah.
And finish it, you know.
But weren't you guys like, I thought you told me, didn't you smoke cigarettes in between, like running, like when they had you running and stuff? Like
No.
I thought
when we went in basic training, I remember I smoked Lucky Strikes, and I was on the bus going to the training base. I'd flown from here, from Vermont, Kentucky. I'd flown from Kentucky to Texas. And I got on the bus, and I lit up a Lucky Strike, and I ate it. The DI, or drill instructor, came by and just shoved it down my throat. And he says, "We don't smoke here."
Shit.
I said, "Well, I believe you." And that was just a good way of proving to you who was boss and so
exactly,
forth.
Yeah.
And... So the whole deal with training with me, I loved it. I mean, you either make it or you don't. And there wasn't very many people that didn't make it. Most guys that go in service, most people make it.
Yeah.
But there's a few that
just doesn't.
Just can't handle it.
Yeah. But once you were past and you were working, like, did you guys have the weekends off? And, like, how did you meet my grandma?
I believe, if I remember correctly, we got a month off a year, 30 days a year leave. And then weekends, I believe we worked a 5-day week, I think, in the shop on vehicles. But once in a while, you had extra duty. You had to work, they called it KP, kitchen police. You had to work in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And you had different jobs that was assigned. They picked so many guys at the lower ranks to work in the kitchen. And you could, if you got there early enough in the morning, they'd pick like 10 guys. You could pick your job, what you wanted to do. You could do pots and pans, or you could do dishes, or you could help the cook or serve or pick up tables. And officers didn't do this, just enlisted men.
Yeah.
And but even there, you worked for people like the good cooks and so forth. They were higher rank. You know, they were usually sergeants or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had the commanding officer, usually a warrant officer or someone like that, in charge of the food service.
And so when you did have the weekends off and stuff, like, what were you doing for fun? Because you've introduced me to a few of your...
Fun. We had more fun. We had boats. We had clubs we went to. We had... a lot of activity. They had a lot of places we went at night.
Yeah.
And you met a lot of women and nice people.
Yeah.
And it was just exciting, let's put it like that.
But did you guys like get paid one day and then on that day everybody went out and like...
A lot of guys would get paid. We got paid every 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a lot of money. I mean,
you can't spend it when you're on the base,
I think,
right?
I made $64 a month or something like that. And we got paid every 2 weeks. I think I got $32 every 2 weeks or something. So you really couldn't go to Hollywood on it. You'd have to stick around.
Yeah.
But a lot of guys would gamble.
Mm-hmm.
On payday, play dice, play cards, whatever. And some guys would come out with a lot of money, and some guys would come out borrowing a dollar from the guy next to him.
Did you do that much?
No, I didn't.
That wasn't your thing?
I didn't like it that well. I mean, I wasn't very good at gambling. I really wasn't.
What was your thing? You shot pool quite a bit, right?
Well, we done that for mostly fun.
Pool. Yeah.
We had a hobby shop we could go to, and we'd go there when we didn't have any money, and we had food at night. We could go there and play pool, or usually it was a bunch of guys there because nobody had a lot of money.
Yeah.
And so they go there to hang out and eat and play pool and sing. Groups of guys would get together, and they'd have groups singing and just have fun.
Yeah.
And this was strictly men. I mean, we didn't have any ladies in the Air Force with us then. I don't know now whether they do or whether they don't, but not. When I was in training at Lackland, they had WAFs, women, but they were in a complete different area.
Were there any gay men at that time?
At that time, no.
Like... Did they exist, but just it was under...
They existed, but very secretly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you ever have any, like, anybody come on to you or anything?
People to make passes and things like that. But, you know, I just never took advantage of it.
Yeah, I would be curious, the timing of that, like, because at that time... It was so suppressed.
Exactly. They kept it secret.
Yeah. What was that called at the time? Was there a name for it?
Well, I believe queers is what they
called
them, you know.
Yeah, which is still t- today.
Still, I don't know what the correct word is for some of this stuff. I really don't.
Yeah, I'm just curious how different it is versus today.
It is totally different.
Yeah.
Life today is totally different. People don't have respect for one another. And that's the bad thing. It really is.
Yeah.
And I feel sorry for people that can't laugh. It's a lot more fun to laugh than it is to frown.
Yeah.
It is. And people they're so possessive of everything. You know.
Well, I know you love cell phones and the internet.
Oh, yes. I love them. I have not one now. I haven't flipped it open for quite a while. Yeah.
I don't like it either.
I believe, and I'm not saying anything against the people that build these things, but I think that's the biggest problem we have in our world today is technology.
Yeah.
And I know it is. It's good for food, for things like this. But why can't, if they're smart enough to build these missiles and all this, seems though they'd be smart enough not to have children that somebody else has to take care of. People have kids today, and they want someone to take care of them. They want to be supplemented on their child care. They want special attention for all. If they didn't have the children to start with, they wouldn't have that problem.
Yeah.
And two work in the family, which I don't really agree with. Because what it costs for child care and transportation and so forth, I think that one parent can stay home. And we've done that. My wife and I finally agreed. She had a real good job, and we kept having to get babysitters. And one day I said, either you're going to quit or I'm going to quit. One of us is going to stay with the kids. We're not going to keep carting the kids around to babysitters.
Yeah.
And we did. Jan stayed home with...
When did you meet her, by the way? Let's talk about that a little bit.
Oh, I met her when I was in service. In Burlington.
Yeah, paint the picture for me.
She was a good looking girl, and I whistled at her, and we went for coffee over at a. There was a bunch of girls and a bunch of guys, and we all went for coffee, and then I never talked to her again for another month or two, I guess, and then I saw her. I actually was. Kind of hooked on her girlfriend, not her. and then we wound up getting together. We went together for a year or two before we decided to get married.
Yeah.
And
you met her parents and stuff?
Huh?
You met her parents before?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They lived in Underhill, which was 15 miles from Essex.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very nice people. But we chose to not live there. I got a job working for a Pontiac dealership in Burlington. And she had a job working for immigration in the federal building.
Mm-hmm.
But she did give that job up to take care of the kids.
She was super smart, though, right?
Very smart. Very, very smart.
Like, was it aggravating?
No. No, she was a very nice person. I really, we just, after you get older and the kids leave, things change.
Mm-hmm.
And they did with both of us. And we just kind of went our separate ways. And that was it, and... So, I never got married again, and don't plan on getting married again.
I mean, you still could if you...
Huh?
You still could if you wanted to.
I don't want to.
Yeah, I know. I you haven't wanted to my entire life.
Why aren't you married?
Probably because I spent so much time with you.
No, but I... people get married and they get, and especially, I know people that have gotten married. One particular person I know, I don't know her personally, but I know of her and I've been to some of her weddings. I think she's been married 6 times. and she likes the Hollywood, the glamour. That's yeah. all it is.
Oh, for sure. We were at a wedding yesterday and like it was great. You know, I was happy. It was yeah. relative. And I can't stand those things, man. I just... Everything about, I don't drink anymore. So that was the only appeal, was to get blackout.
Yeah.
And, you know, open bar. And yeah. now that that's not there, it's like, I don't want to dance. I think it's just, there are some people that are, it really is geared up for them, but I don't have any of that.
Well, life for me has changed tremendously. I mean, I had a garage business for 41 years, I believe.
Yeah.
And I was used to getting up and going to work every day and having a garage. And then I began to lose my physical strength a little bit, my mm-hmm. legs and my knees and so forth. And then I was told by the doctor, you got to get off the cement floor. You got to quit. And that was hard. That was hard to do. And I'm 84 years old. And I feel good, but I can't do the work that I used to do.
Sure.
I
and that was what you did for 40 years.
Huh?
It's what you did for 40 yeah, years, right. too. So it had to have been.
Right.
I don't. It's like an athlete not being able to play anymore.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
You're so used to taking a car and tearing it apart and fixing it and putting it back together or what. And then now I can't even pick the tire up. So, yeah. you know, I mean, it's.
That's well, you fine. Were doing that while you were racing, too.
Well, racing came into that more or less as a challenge, but it also helped me in my business, too. I mean, it benefited, it brought in people for work. You know, they say, if this guy can build a race car, go around the track, you know, on a high rate of speed, he can tune my car up.
Yeah.
And I got a lot of business like that. And from just exposure, you know, going to a racetrack. And I went there. My first race car, Adam, was a Pontiac. And because I worked for a Pontiac dealership, I was very familiar with Pontiac.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a 1956 Pontiac. I paid $50 for it. And I went to the junkyard and bought pipe and put roll bars in it. And I raced it, and I kind of liked it.
Yeah.
And I went to Catamount the first race, and I said, I can't possibly be racing with these cars. They're going too fast.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to another track down in Fairhaven, and I can't remember the name right off, but it was a dirt track. And I ran a few races to get my courage up. And then I went back to Catamount.
How fast were they running at Catamount?
You know, I don't know. Probably top speed, 100 miles an hour.
On a quarter mile track?
It was a third mile, a little bigger than a yeah. quarter.
Still fast.
Yeah, but your car, was, you know, it depended a lot on how it was set up with tires, engines, and they have different rules, mm-hmm. as you know. But back then, it was kindly, it was more or less trust between drivers and mechanics and so forth. You had rules, and you kind of went by them. And they had an inspector to check your car. But most every one of them was pretty honest about it.
Yeah.
And now they have all of these rules. If a tire rolls out of the pits, if... your car don't go fast enough. If the driver shakes his head wrong, and they have all these rules and regulations and cameras, and to me that has really hurt the racing.
Yeah, for sure,
it has hurt it. And what I have noticed lately, they're going back to short tracks. They're racing streets like Chicago, Detroit, and they're going back to these short tracks to create a little whatever between people, and the super speedway business is expensive stuff.
For sure.
It isn't $50.
Yeah, they did that, what, in the early 2000s? Were they... Mile and a half tracks.
2 miles. Yeah. Daytona. I only ran a couple of races on super speedways, but I couldn't afford to do that.
Yeah.
I mean,
what was it like?
Oh, it was quite an experience the first time I went out on a super speedway after running a short track.
Yeah.
The first time I can remember, I went to Daytona, and it was in a borrowed car. I couldn't afford a car like that. And I asked the person in charge of the division, how you qualify? How do you qualify here? And because it rained, and then the first car out wouldn't start or something, I was the first car on the racetrack to qualify. And I said, I have no idea how to do this. And this old boy, his name was Bill Keller. He was a hell of a nice guy. He said, you all just put your foot down to the floor and hold it there. And I said, but what do you do when you get the corner? He said, it'll go around there. Well, unbeknown, I went out in this car, and the throttle stuck on the floor.
Shit.
And I did go around the corner, and I qualified 13th out of like 30, 40 cars. And they, I was so happy.
How'd you get it to stop?
No, I got it.
You got it up? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah,
but for that one lap.
Oh, yeah, you were just ripping. Yeah.
And I often look back at that and tell everybody what a phony I was.
Oh, like, yeah.
You just naturally, if you can picture going to, say, 150, 60 miles an hour, you're going into a corner, and it looks like you're sticking your head in a funnel is what it looks like.
Yeah.
The track is really wide, but as you look down, it looks like a funnel to me.
Mm-hmm.
But the car, if they're they'll go. I mean, when I raced, it's nothing like it is today. Today is totally different.
Well, that first car, you said you put $50 in.
Oh, that was a car that I ran just a group of guys had cars, and most of them were 55 Chevrolets, 55, 56 Fords, and I think my car was a Pontiac.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't really competitive because I didn't drive it. I mean, you know, it takes a while to get used to that. You don't jump in a car and go out and set the world speed record.
Yeah. Well, how did you get what was your progression?
Experience primarily. And learning more about what you can run and how to stagger your tires and how to wait. Weight became a big factor.
Mm-hmm.
Tire width became a big factor. Gear ratio. All of this goes into that.
So you're doing all that on top of your business, your garage business.
Well, I had helpers, volunteer helpers.
Yeah.
I don't think I ever paid anyone to help me.
Mm-hmm.
It was mostly people interested, like me, in the competition. It's a competition.
Yeah.
It's like wrestling, play, but you're alone in the car.
Yeah.
It's sort of like golf, you know. You're on your own.
But when you were running the shop during the day,
yeah,
was that going on during the day too, or was
no.
After work?
No, my deal with racing was not work on the race car doing working hours at the shop.
Yeah.
That was an after.
That had to have been tough sometimes, though.
Well, it was. But I just made it a point. The race car was outside doing working hours.
Yeah.
I never.
So how would you do that then? You'd work 9 to 5 at the shop, and then
I'd work 6 to 10 usually, and then from 10 to 12 I'd work on race car if I had time.
Yeah.
But we didn't tear up a lot of cars like they do now. We'd wreck and bend the fenders or so forth, but we'd
nothing,
go to the junkyard,
crazy,
get the parts, and see, they were stock cars.
Yeah.
And they were they were stock. They were actually cars from people
had
gotten rid of. And we'd use the parts off of them.
So how many nights a week were you racing?
I think 71, 72. I think I raced 91 races one summer, 91 feature races.
Wow.
And 92 the next summer, or vice versa.
Yeah, I guess it's not all year round, right?
No, just a summer. But we raced, the first night we raced is Canada. It was on a Wednesday night. Thursday night, we raced Barrie. Friday night, we raced in Plattsburgh. Friday night, Fairhaven, maybe. And then Saturday night, Plattsburgh. And then sometimes Sundays, we'd race. We had a pretty full schedule.
Were you making money doing it?
Not much.
Just covering the cost of...
Covering the cost. And, you know, by the time you pay for your gas and pay for the pit crew and things like that to get in, you didn't make a lot of money.
Yeah.
You had
but were
a point
you winning?
Fund, huh?
Were you winning?
Winning?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was winning occasionally, yeah.
Yeah.
There was a lot of guys won more races than I won. But I set a limit on what I would spend.
Yeah.
No, I really did.
Yeah.
And a lot of guys didn't. A lot of guys just went all out and went broke. There was a lot of
like
guys.
How much would you spend on a season?
Oh, I don't know. Tires was the biggest expense.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on what kind of tires we had, the tires I ran used to run about $50 a piece back in the day. Now they're like $200 a piece or something. But they were M&H slicks, and then Firestone made them, Goodyear made them. It all depended on those. That was one of the biggest expenses. And then engines. See, we used to use stock engines when we first started. Stock cars, right? But then like Petty and those guys, they started building their own engines and doing here, not cheating, but maybe fixing one a little bit better than the other.
For sure.
And, Richard Petty, I knew Richard Petty quite well. And I bought some parts from him. But it was because he was so good at doing it, and his dad was good, and his uncle was just fantastic.
Yeah.
And he had a brother that was good. I don't know whatever happened to your brother.
Did you think that at any point you were going to go and do that, like, professionally?
Oh, yeah. That's everyone's dream.
Yeah.
Like, anybody's dream. I mean, you think of it, but then it comes to reality after a little while. You gotta say, "Hey, this deal ain't working.
Yeah.
I gotta slow down here."
Do you think you could have though?
I had an offer to.
Really?
Yeah, I had an offer from I don't know. I can't remember the guy's name from Dodge. To go race, on a tour type mm-hmm. deal. But I refused because I had the garage, I had two kids and a wife.
Yeah.
And no way I was going to trade all that for a race car.
So when did you officially stop driving then?
When I stopped, they updated the cars to quick change rear ends and factory or professionally built motors and things like that. That's when I decided to stop because it was just too much.
Yeah.
And then the travel, they started racing all over the place. Hell, they would be in Virginia one weekend and California somewhere, And when I'm exaggerating a little bit, but they did race a lot of different places.
When you were doing it, like 90 races that summer, what time were the races at?
What kind?
What time?
You in the evening.
Evening?
Evening.
So it would be, 7 o'clock or something?
Yeah.
And they'd get done at
10.
And then you were up at 5 every day after
that?
Yeah,
I don't know how I'd done it.
Yeah.
I'd give anything in the world if I could do it now for a day.
Yeah, because at the time, weren't you smoking like crazy? Like you were two packs a day?
I smoke, but you didn't have time to smoke.
Really?
Hell, you'd light a cigarette and you'd have to be doing something.
I thought you were smoking a lot when you had the shop.
I did.
Yeah.
I did. I really did. But I'd light a cigarette and lay it down. I mean, of course, it was steel benches, so yeah, it didn't hurt anything. And then half the time, I'd have two or three cigarettes lined up.
Yeah.
They'd burn out.
Yeah.
But it wasn't good for me.
I don't think you were smoking when I was a kid. I don't remember.
I quit a couple of times. But yeah. The last time I really quit was in 94, I guess.
When you had a heart attack?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think it was the smoking that got you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The doctor told me what it was.
Yeah.
And the doctor was very nice. He said, if you want to keep smoking, you can keep smoking. But in about 2 years, I want you to hang out pretty close to this hospital because you're going to be right back in here.
God damn.
And that made me believe that smoking wasn't good for you.
Yeah.
And I never had any more trouble like that.
But when you were growing up, I mean, you were born in Kentucky. Tobacco was everywhere. Like, did
Kentucky,
you even think of it?
They raised tobacco.
Yeah.
They raised tobacco. And they used to have these auctions where they'd sell tobacco off. Your tobacco crop, depending on the size of your farm, I worked for one guy that grew tobacco. And in this particular place, I think he was allowed 3 acres of his land was dedicated to tobacco. Mm-hmm. And the government at that time, I believe, assisted him in that 3 acres. The government helped him some. And you could plant, actually, 3.5 acres. And before you harvested, you had to cut the outside off. The outside usually didn't grow too good. So you'd plant more than you needed, cut the outside off, and that left you prime tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the fall, when they harvested, they used to take their tobacco up. You'd put it, when they harvested, it'd come in big bunches. And they'd hang it in barns and let it dry. And then when it dried, they would take it to auctions. And I remember they were up in West Virginia, I believe. And companies like Philip Morris and Lucky Strike Camel, Winston, or, you know.
They would bid on it?
They would bid on the whole deal.
Huh.
Yeah. And they'd buy it.
And what were you chewing it? Were you, what? If you were working on stuff.
No, I never chewed tobacco that much.
Yeah,
no,
you didn't?
No. No, a lot of people did.
Yeah.
And snuff, they have that snuff, but I don't know what that's made.
Snuff is?
I think it's a form of tobacco.
What do you do with it?
Yeah, you just put it under your lip, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
Whatever.
That. Yeah, because there's also one that you snort. They make that too.
I never got into that. Yeah. That's after my time.
Yeah, I can't imagine that's good for you. We jumped around a little bit, but who gave you the nickname the Kentucky Colonel?
I would have to say probably Ken Squire.
Okay.
He was a promoter at, he announced everywhere, you know, Daytona is where he really started. I think he done the first 1959, wasn't it, when they first started down there?
Yeah, I think you're
CBS.
Right.
He done that one.
And you were sponsored by KFC?
Oh, that was up here, Kentucky Fried Chicken, but that was local.
Yeah.
That was just stores in Burlington. I think there was 4 or 5 stores at that time.
You had what, KFC and RC Cola sponsored
RC
you?
RC Cola, and that was a soft drink.
Yeah.
And they, well, they give me, I remember the kids at Catamount. I had 2 big rubbish cans, and I'd fill them with orange and RC, and I'd bring them and put ice in there. And at night after the race, I'd give it to the kids.
Yeah.
I had more kids after me than, well, you know, they got a free soda and.
Yeah.
And the company,
did you get free KFC too? Was that part of the deal?
Occasionally.
Yeah.
If I went by a KFC store, I did. But,
yeah.
I didn't go there asking them for it.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Once in a while, I'd go by with a car, maybe stop in Barrie or somewhere like that, going to the races, and I'd order a bucket of chicken. They'd say, well, it's on me. And
yeah.
That was kind of nice. You
That's
know?
Awesome.
Yeah.
All right. I had a couple people ask questions. just that we're curious. Who is the toughest? Matt Benoit asks, who's the toughest driver you ever raced against and why?
That's a hard question. That is really a very hard question. Because I raced in quite a few different divisions. And then a lot of these drivers were experienced. But I can say the hardest I ever got hit by a driver was Buddy Baker. You ever hear of Buddy Baker?
No.
His father, Buck Baker, was a driver. And I was racing in somewhere in New York out near Pennsylvania. And I was in his way. And he proceeded to move me out of the way. And I thought it broke my neck. He hit me so hard. But it was just a simple way of saying, get the hell out of my way. I'm going through. And that I remember. But then there was occasions where you'd get in these little confrontations. Somebody would bump you, and, of course, you'd get angry, and you want to wreck them. And I had different occasions there. I mean, probably with half of the race car drivers, and you'll see it today. You even watch a race.
What was your reputation as a driver?
God, I don't know.
Really?
I thought I was respected. And I know one thing. Lisa could tell you. She'd say, he's going to get this guy back. But once in a while, if you took a few laps just to cool off, you'd be okay.
Yeah.
Because not every incident was meant to harm you.
No.
You know, most of the accidents in racing is accidental.
Yeah.
But if it occurs more than once, then it's not accidental. If it keeps happening, you know it's meant to be.
Well, you introduced me to a friend of yours that I think he had a bit of a reputation as a wild card, Clem.
Oh, my God.
Clem Despo?
But Clem Despo wasn't a... Clem liked to maybe bend the rules a little
okay.
bit.
Okay. He wasn't a kamikaze out there?
No.
I didn't.
He was a fun guy.
Yeah.
I loved to watch him. And
was he good?
Fair. Yeah, he was fair.
Yeah, I'm putting you on the spot right now.
I liked him, you know. But he would get in accidents sometimes that probably he could have prevented.
Yeah.
You know, he might not hit the brake hard enough or something, you know. But
it's funny because most of these guys that you introduced me to, it was after their racing career. And it was me sitting in a cabin with them all getting drunk.
Oh, yeah.
So I had no idea. Yeah. I mean,
yeah. They, you know, it's funny how over the years you learn to appreciate those guys.
Yeah.
And they're like real friends.
Oh,
they
yeah.
really are. And even today, you know, there's none of them that I dislike. You know, none of them.
Yeah.
And just the other day, I raced with a guy from Canada. His name was Jean-Paul Cabana.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really good. I mean, he done a lot of racing, and in Canada especially. So the other day, I called.
Sorry, just want to make sure that.
I found a phone number with his number on it, and I called that number, and he answered. And this has been... Well, 20 years probably since I've seen him. And he invited me up to Canada to race. He has a race car school up there, and he told me if I came up here, I could drive one of his cars, and he wouldn't charge me anything.
That's awesome.
And he knew when I called who it was.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So that's the kind of friendship we had. I mean, the guys just were really, it's like any sport, you know, most any sport. Once in a great while, you have a real sore loser, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And they carry that on for life, and it just hurts them more than it does anybody.
Yeah, I call that my younger brother, Austin.
Oh, yeah? Is that right?
I was trying to explain to his wife yesterday what it was like growing up with him. Like, Austin is the most competitive person. I mean, my dad is very competitive, you know. But Austin, he was from the age of 4 to 9. If he didn't win whatever it was, it would be like, it would ruin whatever it was. The whole day would be gone. It was insane. And somehow he kind of got out of it, but it's still there a little bit. Yeah. And when it shows, it's...
Well, everyone is different. Everyone. Yeah. And even, well, this past week, they had a race in Chicago or somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't happen to watch the whole thing. But a driver from some other country won. And they said he was a rookie at all this. I think the guy had won like 180 races or something like that. He wasn't a rookie.
Yeah, yeah.
He knew what he was doing.
Yeah, who was it?
I don't know.
Huh.
I don't know. Your dad knows.
Yeah, I'd be curious about
that. Yeah, you'll have to ask him. Yeah.
All right, okay. Well, let's do one more question, then we'll get you out of here because it's starting to get warm and, you know, you've given a lot of your secrets away. Let's see. I mean, you've talked a little bit about, like, reflecting on life, and I was just curious, like, at 84, is there anything you wish you would have done differently or anything, like, do you have any advice to younger people?
I do. I think be good to people. That's the first thing. And be honest with people. And I wouldn't trade my life for anybody's. I've been lucky. I met the most beautiful people of my life, you know, and I'm not ashamed of anything. I tried my best, but it wasn't always good enough. And it didn't satisfy everybody. And you're not going to satisfy everybody. I don't care how hard you try. You know, you can do your very, very best, and you're going to have some people that's going to criticize you.
Yep.
And that really upsets you, and that's when you have to really suck it in. And but I wouldn't trade my life. No. What I've done, I've enjoyed most all of my life. I've had disappointments, and I've tried to give advice to people, but you know, advice is free, right?
Yeah.
You don't pay for it. Anybody will give you advice for nothing. And I've gotten a lot of good advice from people. And you know, you're great-grandfather was a person that I really admired. He would tell me things that I never even thought of, you know. I mean, I remember once, you didn't know him too well, did you?
Not super well.
No. But he, I would go to him if I'd get in, well, if I'd have financial troubles, I'd go talk to him. And I'll never forget, I got the gas station grounds all done, the building all up and everything. And the oil company I was with said, we can't help you because there was a shortage in 73 when I opened that station. And I said, I don't know what I'm going to do. I've borrowed all I can borrow. No. He said, you go back and get $10,000 more from the bank. And I said, how can I do that? He said, you got so much invested now. If they don't give you $10,000 more, they're crazy. You know, and things like that. But I had people I could talk to.
Yeah.
I really did. And most people gave me good advice.
Yeah. He was a...
He was a smart man.
Yeah.
Very smart man.
Yeah. He's...
And a lot of people disagreed with him. A lot of people didn't like him. I never had any problem with him. Never at all.
Yeah.
And I loved my him and Grampy and Grammy.
Yeah.
They were called. And Grammy used to bake me, every time I go to deer camp, we all go to deer camp, she'd bake me 2 apple pies. And then once in a while, he'd stop by deer camp. We always hunted mostly on his land.
Yeah.
And I have no regrets. Hell, I'd like to start all over again right now.
Yeah.
But I can't. I just got to keep going where I'm at.
Yeah.
Boy, the road ain't too far ahead. You take a tape measure and pull it out and you measure.
Yeah.
That, damn 84 is coming up toward it.
Well, that's part of the reason why I want to have you on.
Yeah.
You know, like,
well, that's exactly right. You're exactly
right. It's been, we started spending time together when I was, I mean, really when I was around 8 or 9. And every summer I would come up and spend with you.
Remember the fish you caught up there?
Yeah.
And remember me pulling your ear, and the lady said she's going to have me put in jail because I pulled your ear?
Yeah,
I made you put that candy back.
We didn't get along always, but it was.
I remember that so well. I told you no candy, and the first thing you done, grab a candy bar. And I said, put it back. You said, no, I got you by the ear. And you put it back. And that lady said, I could have you arrested. Yeah. I said, that's my grandson, lady.
That's
I told so many people.
Yeah,
about
I like to eat when I was younger.
Yeah,
was
your mom said when you got home from camp, all you wanted to eat was trout and peas. Well, that's good talking to you. I love you to death.
I love you too. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
Pleasure. I hope didn't hurt anybody's feelings.
No, I mean, even if you did.
You just called me.
Yeah. Anybody watching, first off, thanks for submitting questions. We got to as many as we could, but thank you for listening. If you just listen to us, rate and review us wherever you're listening. If you're watching us on YouTube, hit that notifications bell so you don't miss our upcoming content. And then we are on Patreon, patreon.com/FNFpod. And as always, follow us on Instagram @FNFpod. We're going to leave you with Jaga.
I just make the waves, I don't write them. I can hear the lyrics in my spirit as I write them. Why you wanna walk and talk just like them? I can't get caught up in all the hype and the excitement. I just make the waves, I don't write them. I can hear the lyrics in my spirit as I write them. Why you wanna walk and talk just like them? I can't get caught up in all the hype and the excitement. Welcome to my wave pool, welcome to my wave pool. 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 My wave pool, welcome to my wave pool.